Session number 10247, reel 5.
Mr. Pomeroy, reel 5. Did the Aboriginal population take any kind of attitude towards the armed struggle that was going on?
Well, these groups have no political character whatsoever or understanding of political affairs, and we came in contact with these people, but they, I don't think, ever really understood what we were doing in the mountains. In many areas, we were able to form good relations with these people, mainly on the basis of bartering things that they need with them. For instance, their chief interest in most of these groups is to obtain salt and tobacco, which they don't have for themselves. So much of their trading activity or relations with towns and settled places is for the purposes of trade, to get these two objects. And if we provided them with these things, why, they helped us. If we were not able to provide them, why, they would be liable to go to the army and get it there and help the army. And the total lack of loyalty to any particular group or cause. So for us in the mountains, they were very often a threat, because they would betray our camp areas to the army, not because they were anti our group, but because they felt they could get from the army things that we couldn't provide them. That's the kind of condition they were in, or attitude that they had.
But likewise, they might freely give you information about the army.
Oh, yes. And many of them worked very closely with our people, and they were even politicalized to some extent.
One of the things that's always stuck in my mind about your book was a description of an incident in which somebody, I think, from the Hok movement was captured and gave information to the authorities under torture, or the threat of torture, and then I think was punished for it afterwards when he got back, was released, and somehow got back to the Hoks. And I think it stood out in my memory so sharply because of the pitiable condition that somebody like that would find themselves in, and what struck me is a very ruthless way of dealing with him. Do you think there's justification for that type of thing?
I think I described the incident of a young girl, in fact, who was executed because she had done this. There were several incidents like that that occurred in the course of the struggle, and eventually these were re-examined by the movement and considered to have been mistakes and incorrect behavior by the movement. In fact, very serious mistakes.
Can you describe the conditions under which you were living under in the jungle, for people who've got no first-hand experience of it, what it's like to live under conditions of tropical jungle when you're being hunted?
Well, to live in the mountains, even under guerrilla conditions, in many ways I found rather enjoyable. I mean, living in a hut in the forest with beautiful surroundings very often, and it was rather pleasant in that respect. But when you are unable to get proper food, and when you are forced to move under conditions of difficult terrain without food, it can be very difficult indeed. And throughout our experience of 2 years in the mountains, we never had a fully satisfying meal, in the sense of having all the nourishment we want, or as much of it we would want. We lived usually in camps rather remote from inhabited places, and our supply lines were maintained by our own armed groups, who went down to the towns and villages to pick up food and bring it back, which sometimes required journeys of a couple of days, and which means they couldn't carry a great deal. So we always had limited supplies, and these were very strictly rationed. We had a very strict ration system. We had a supply officer who would ration out to each household the same amount of food, regardless of how much there was there. And we were hungry a great deal of the time.
Were you able to get hold of food that the government forces had left behind on any occasions?
No, not really. Not really, no.
What about the question of aeroplanes and air power? To what extent did that worry you in the jungle?
Well, living in the jungle, which is very has very dense foliage, it's very easy to hide from aircraft. Our only problem in regard to aircraft was doing our cooking and having our cooking fires going. If we did that during the daytime, the smoke would rise above the trees and would be easily detected by aircraft. So we had very strict arrangements of cooking only prior to daylight hours, before it became really light, or we would cook late in the afternoon when it began to get dark, so that no smoke would be produced.
You were telling me earlier on about someone who defected from the movement. To what extent was that a worry, that people would become disillusioned or weakened in the jungle so that they might give up and give information to the authorities?
Well, in the early years of this post-war hook struggle, there were practically no examples of that kind. It was only after the movement began to suffer serious reverses in the 1950s that the movement lost its momentum and was thrown back onto the defensive. It was only at that time that we began to have a surrenderee phenomenon of well, it affected all levels of the movement, from the lower ranks up to even top leaders.
Would these people help the authorities to any great extent?
Some of them, yes. This man, Louis Tarouk, whose autobiography I wrote and it was published called Born of the People, he surrendered around 1954, or something like that. But you see, his surrender was not so much due to depression because of the situation of the movement. It was mainly because he was an ambitious fellow who didn't obtain the positions of leadership in the movement that he wanted. And this led to conflict with other people in the movement. It was largely for that reason, this disappointed ambitions in the movement, that led them to take that path. Of course, you know, the trouble with the people of this kind who defect, invariably their tendency is to justify what they did. And the only way they feel they can justify it is by attacking what they claim are the weaknesses or the wrongdoings of the movement. So they blame their own actions on the movement rather than on their own personal weakness. That's why almost all defectors tend to be anti of the movement they have left, and to deride it and condemn it and denigrate it, mainly because they're protecting their own egos when they do so.
One of the things that always fascinates people about guerrilla movements is the question of why it is that some succeed and others fail. There have been some spectacular victories of guerrilla movements or armed resistance movements like Vietnam in recent years, and others like the Philippines movement and Malaya, where they failed. What do you think are the reasons why some fail and some succeed? Can you isolate the reasons?
Yes, well, the movement in the Philippines has been reviewing this period very extensively and subjecting it to criticism. And in general, it's concluded that the defeat of the hook struggle in the 1940s, 1950s was mainly due to the mistakes of the movement and the errors of the movement and not to the strength of the other side, although the strength of the other side has to be taken into account in this. is felt that the movement was mistaken in attempting to launch an all-out armed struggle. It was mistaken in devoting its full attention to the armed aspect of struggle, to the neglect of all legal forms. It was mistaken in its estimate that a revolutionary situation existed at a given time, that is, around the beginning of 1950, and used this estimate as the basis for launching a full-scale offensive. It's felt that that was an erroneous estimate, and that the movement simply made its offensive into the face of enemy strength that it had underestimated. So, in general, these various aspects of weakness are very heavily criticized in the movement. You know, eventually the Philippine Communist Party made the complete shift from armed struggle to a legal struggle. The armed forces were maintained on various levels of strength up until the year 1974, for that matter. Even though the main struggle had been defeated by the latter 1950s, armed groups were still maintained in the movement. The party was underground, using armed groups mainly for defensive purposes. The shift was finally made around 1974 during the regime of President Marcos. And the shift was made because it was felt that although an armed struggle condition can be maintained in the Philippines almost indefinitely under Philippine circumstances, at one either at a low level or a moderate level, this really does not satisfy the needs of the revolutionary movement in the Philippines, which it is felt should be based more on the utmost amount of mass organization of the people and politicalization of the people through mass organization. And that's why the movement made the shift totally to a legal struggle, to enable it to have wider contact with the broadest masses of people, to develop them through trade unions, peasant movements, peace movements, anti-imperialist movements of all kinds, to achieve the aims of the movement. The armed struggle to some extent becomes an elitist form of struggle in the sense that it's become centered in the small armed groups that are waging the struggle, but these might be able to maintain themselves and even score little military victories. But in the meantime, the people as a whole are not being organized or put through the experience of organization. And the party in the Philippines concluded that what is needed to make the shift to the utmost mass mobilization.
On this question of why some guerrilla movements fail and why some succeed, many people say that if you've got some kind of outside help, like the Vietnamese had a channel through to fraternal countries like China and Russia through a common border with China, that this is a big factor in the success or otherwise of guerrilla movements. Some people might say with the American Revolution, with the contact with France and so on. But did the Philippine movement get any outside help at all?
No, it didn't. Not any whatsoever. And this, in fact, is one of the points of criticism of the adoption of the tactics that and strategy and tactics that were used, because it was not taken sufficiently into account that the movement would have great difficulty in winning on its own against a very powerful enemy like American imperialism. That factor is very strong. And see, in the Philippines is an island archipelago. It is quite remote from the mainland, and it's very difficult to import arms from abroad. Incidentally, the armed struggle is occurring in the Philippines today under what is called a New People's Army, which was created by Maoist groups. They attempted to get arms from China because their links were with China. A ship carrying arms for this movement was captured by the Philippine government as soon as it arrived in Philippine waters. It was, I think it was a lesson to the Chinese themselves of the difficulties of doing this.
Another factor that's pointed to in the question of success and failure is the question of divisions within the civilian population. Many people say that the reason why the movement in Malaya failed was because of it being a multi-racial society, multicultural society. Was there any factor of that kind in the Philippines, or is the population fairly uniform in that respect?
Well, actually, the Philippine population is rather diverse because there are quite a large number of different language groups and regional groups in the country, which have their own dialect or even some of their own customs in some areas. But this never really posed a problem for our movement. No, not a problem, not in our movement. I don't know of any differences that arose on a regional basis within the movement. I'm not aware of any. I certainly never observed any in a movement where I saw people from different regions mixed in the same units.
Though you have earlier pointed to the distinctiveness of the Muslims in the south, were the Muslims recruited to your movement?
No, we didn't have any contact with the Muslims. In fact, in the island of Mindanao itself, which is the Muslim area, it's the large southern island in the Philippines. The Hook movement in the 1940s and 50s managed to have a couple of expansion teams go to Mindanao, but they never succeeded in developing a struggle there. Most of them were arrested before they could really do much organization.
Did you ever get defectors from the Filipino army or paramilitary forces?
Yes, there were some. There were some in the movement.
I've
met some. Mm-hmm.
Did they make any contribution at all?
Well, they were part of the armed forces. Some of them were even military commanders, commanders of squadrons in the various parts of the country. Yeah, there were some.
Were they able to help with military expertise? Or did they have nothing to do?
Well, they were not of that top caliber. Most of them were low-ranking elements in the army. There weren't any of the officer caliber who switched.
But presumably they'd be able to teach people how to use weapons.
Yes, that. Mm-hmm, true.
Can we go on to your capture and imprisonment, and can you tell me what happened to you under imprisonment and the conditions you had to face?
Well, my wife and I were both captured in a surprise attack on a camp of ours in the province of Nueva Ecija in April of 1952. We were charged with rebellion, complex with murder, arson, robbery, and kidnapping, which was the blanket charge used against all Hooks or all captured people. And we were tried and we were sentenced to life imprisonment. This was early in 1952. Well, we were in prison about 10 years. We served about 10 years of the life sentence. Came out of prison in the beginning of 1962. We were in prison with a large number of other political prisoners from our movement, for instance, all of the leaders who had been arrested in 1950 in this big mass raid, which stripped the movement of its leadership at the time, were still in prison at that time. They remained in prison for 20 years, as a matter of fact, the main leading people. They were in prison when we were there, and quite a number of the Central Committee members of the party who had been captured, and a large number of ordinary rank-and-file hooks or party people. There were, at any given time, maybe 200 to 250 political prisoners. Initially, we were confined in the National Penitentiary, the National Prison, in a place called Muntinlupa is the name of the prison, which is south of the city of Manila, in the countryside. And the political prisoners were confined in a building, the lower part of a building, which was called the cell house, of individual cells, which is originally constructed for purposes of the punishment of prisoners who are guilty of infraction of prison rules and so on. In other words, they were present punishment cells. That's what they were designed for. And those people who had any leading role in the movement were confined in individual cells. My wife and I were put with this group of leading cadres in the movement because we had played some kind of leading role. And there was one group of about 20 or more of us who were confined in individual cells. The other rank-and-file people were crammed into the same cells of the same size, but with about six or seven in a cell, which means very cramped, crowded conditions. My wife was put into this prison, although it was totally a men's prison. She was put there with five or six other women comrades from the movement in these individual cells. Eventually, my wife and the other women were transferred out of that prison and put in a separate women's prison. But initially, we were all in the same prison. We were confined in these individual cells. The only time we ever left the cells was to go out into the open for half an hour a day for what they called sunning, just to get some open air. This was only when the sun was shining, and if the sun wasn't shining, why they didn't let us out? And there would be very long periods of rainy in the rainy season when we never left the cell. So we were in the cell, then initially for a period of years, we were denied all reading materials. All writing materials were forbidden unless we were allowed to write a letter every 2 weeks. And we were simply sitting in the cells. Even the food was brought to us. We're not allowed to go out to obtain our food. It was brought to our cell in big containers, and the guard would open the door and give us the food and close the door. And so we were totally isolated like this. Except we're not totally isolated. I mean, we were confined individually in cells, but our group of political prisoners could shout to each other across the corridor or down a corridor. Maintain that kind of contact. Otherwise, we are isolated individually. And I had that solitary confinement type of thing for 5 or 6 years. Eventually, we were able to get reading materials after a long struggle. But heavily censored reading materials. We were denied all newspapers and news magazines. Anything that would give us news of what was happening outside was forbidden to us. And we could get maybe novels or stuff like that to read. For instance, they would give us a Time magazine if a visitor brought it to us, and they would tear out all the news pages, and we would have only the back pages with the news about medicine or something, silly stuff like that was going on. But eventually we managed to break down that barrier and get some reading materials. But while we were in that prison, I don't remember the exact year, but it was after 5 or 6 years, an extremely terrible prison riot occurred in the prison. The riot occurred between two rival gangs inside the prison who were fighting each other for control of prison rackets and stuff. And they mobilized to their sides thousands of the prisoners in the... This prison was originally built to hold 2,000 prisoners, and there were about 8,000 or 9,000 crammed into the prison. Terrible crowding. And a riot broke out. It was an absolute murder in the prison. So many were killed on each side. And the prison was simply taken over by the gangs at one point, and they were killing each other inside the prison. In the place where we were, there was one gang was located in the upstairs parts of the building, and many of these punishment cells were occupied by members of these gangs who had been caught by the prison authorities and punished by putting them in cells. So in this cell house, we had our political prisoners, we had all these ordinary criminals who were confined for these punishment purposes. And when the riot occurred, the members of the gang in the upstairs swarmed down, drove out the guards, and besieged the prisoners and their enemies in the various cells. An absolute butchery occurred in these cells, almost in front of our cells, you know. And we had great difficulty persuading these gangs not to touch any of our cells and to involve us in the struggle. And our political prisoners were very highly regarded in the prison, and people had great respect for Hooks. They didn't touch us while they were murdering each other, you see, in these terrible, terrible conditions. But this eventually affected our life in the prison. We were taken out of the punishment cells because they wanted to put the gang members there. And eventually our whole political prisoner group was transferred away from the prison and put into an army compound where we were totally on our own. And we were kept in that compound up to the time when I was finally released. My wife and I were finally released because a campaign was started for us for our release by our American comrades whom I had known in the United States. They eventually set up a committee and worked for our release. And also the Philippine Supreme Court eventually ruled that the charge under which we were convicted was illegal. I mean, it was not part of the penal code. It was invented by the army lawyers. So that could be used as a basis for appealing against our sentence. And we fought our case all the way up to the Philippine Supreme Court to be released. And we got turned down all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court even rejected our final appeal. But the Supreme Court finally made the ruling that we could be pardoned by the Philippine president. We had grounds for that. So we worked for a pardon. And together with this campaign in the U.S. and our own efforts in the Philippines, my wife and I succeeded in getting a pardon.
One thing that you said you'd come back to, which I don't think we did, was when I raised this question of the question of the intimidation of the civilian population by guerrillas, and you said mm-hmm. that in the spread of the Hook movement, there was something to be criticized.
I mean, the abuse of the population?
Yes.